Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and joined by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, have you been practicing with the kids? Are they ready for Friday night?
We're working on it. My oldest is ready. The two-year-old, he likes to interject bathroom words in the middle of Manishtana, so we're trying to get him to stop. Mm.
So a lot of Manishtana, Laila. I remember those years when I would have to practice, yes, with the kids.
Yeah.
Lots of fun, lots of songs that they're learning at Gan. And
yes,
the Seder I always find to be really a lovely gathering. Always love Pesach. Great holiday, in my view. As opposed to Purim, which we spoke about, not a fan of too much.
Right. Well, I like both. Food's not great on Pesach, but I do like spending the time with my family. And, you know, my grandfather was a professional chazan. Now he's long retired, but we sing a lot at the Seder, and it's nice.
Very nice. I will just say that one thing I don't particularly like too much about Pesach is what I had to do last night, which is clean out the fridge and the freezer. It takes a long time to get that done.
Yes.
And it's not easy, not an easy job. I was worn out, and it was just the refrigerator, like nothing else, just the refrigerator. But anyhow, you know, with Pesach around the corner, it kind of ties into our guest this week, who is IDF retired Brigadier General Gal Hirsch, who was basically one of the key officers who came up with the idea back 20 years ago in 2002 to launch what became known as Operation Defensive Shield. He tells us in the interview how he gave the operation its name. And this was an operation that many of you might remember was launched in 2002 after the horrific bombing at the Park Hotel in Netanya on the night of the Seder, and led to the death of 30 Israelis. We actually have a story, you can find it online or in print in the magazine this weekend, by Naomi Reagan, who is a famous author, who was at the Park Hotel that night for the Seder 20 years ago with her family, and thankfully they were okay. But she retells the story and the trauma and the tragedy that followed it. But that'll be later on in the show. For now, Lahav, one of the big stories this week is obviously the continuation, unfortunately, of the terrorist attacks and the response of the head of the Joint List, Ayman Uda. What exactly did he do?
Yeah, well, I think we should go back. I mean, the day that our previous episode of the podcast came out, it was the day of that terrible shooting in Tel Aviv, on Dizengoff Street in Tel Aviv, that someone, you know, that a Palestinian man went on this rampage, and then there was this long manhunt, and it was a really scary evening.
And correct me if I'm wrong, you used to live until not long ago right near there, right?
Yes. That was, for me, that was like very eerie watching the news that like literally on my block, like people running away. Like there's this movie theater on Kikar Dizengoff, and that was like the end of my block. Mm-hmm. And that whole area was cordoned off, and you see people running away, and very eerie for me to watch on the news. But we have people at JPost who live right there also, who were sending in videos from their windows, you know,
right,
of the manhunt going on in the streets. And it was, on the one hand, fewer people died than in Bnei Brak, but on the other hand, the manhunt sort of continued for hours, and somehow the army and the police didn't block off the media from following them. So when you watched on the news, you felt like you were right there, and it was scary to watch.
By the way, it was crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, it was scary to watch. I felt like I was watching an episode of 24. Remember that? It was like suspense,
or just like Cops,
or Cops.
You know those shows in the U.S.
True.
Cops,
or but
yeah.
But it was a little crazy. I mean, I think, you know, but there's been a large debate now within Israel about who was at fault there. Was it the media? Was it the police? Was it the army? It was just a balagan, right? The whole thing was just chaotic. It was anarchy. The police were not in control of the situation. And
yeah,
I think journalists also overstepped to an extent the boundaries. When soldiers are going door to door in apartment buildings, they don't have to have a camera stuck in their face, right? Back off. There was something that was uncomfortable for me watching that, even though as a journalist, I understand the need to get there and be there and tell the story. but it made me a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think in the heat of the moment, it's hard to blame someone, but it was not what a night like that should have looked like, for sure. But in the meantime, I mean, the government is trying to take action in different ways. They just put 360 million shekels into repairing the security barrier, which has had a lot of holes in it for a long time. And they're also working on other deterrent steps, like possibly taking away welfare payments to the families of terrorists if it's shown that they helped the terrorists or didn't turn them in and knew what they were going to do.
Not to mention the IDF operations that have escalated in the West Bank and particularly in Jenin, where the attacker came from.
Right. And that also, like, we didn't talk about Jenin specifically with Gal Hirsch, but that also brings us back 20 years because that was the site of a very big battle in the during Operation Defensive Shield.
But the Ayman Ouda, who is the leader of the joint list, right? So people are more familiar, I'd say, nowadays with Mansour Abbas, who's the leader of RAM, the Islamist Arab Party that's part of the governing coalition led by Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid. But Ayman Ouda, who leads us, six or seven seats in the Knesset in the opposition, the joint list, which used to be the Arab Party, it came out this week and said, Arab policemen, and there are a significant number of Arab policemen, should lay down their weapons and should not be cooperating with the Zionist regime. The police have basically referred this to the Attorney General and said you should consider whether this meets the legal threshold of incitement and charges should be brought against him.
Yeah, I mean, he presented it just as a total betrayal. Like, if you're Arab and you're a policeman, you're betraying your fellow Arabs. And I think that, you know, you look back to when Ayman Ouda entered politics, I believe it was for the 2015 election, and they started the joint list where they brought a bunch of Arab parties together. And you had outlets like The New Yorker calling him the next, like, the Martin Luther King Jr. of Israel. And I think we in Israel knew from the get-go that he was not that. Mm-hmm. If anyone, I mean, we have Mansour Abbas who's doing that, but Ouda never was as seeking a coexistence the way Abbas has been. And, you know, as time goes on, it just further proves that the joint list and, you know, the sort of establishment older Arab parties and way of doing politics in Israel is violent and corrupt, frankly. I mean, these are people who think that the state of Israel as a Jewish state should not exist. And then they come back and complain, you know, oh, why can't we, you know, why aren't the conditions better? Well, I mean, you're not willing to play the game of this country that, you know, that truly enter the politics of this country and be advocates for your people within this government, you know, so it just happens again and again.
Yeah, I think what it also comes down to is, you know, what Mansour Abbas did, for example, is for decades, the Arab members of Knesset were focused on a singular issue, and that was the Palestinians. It was the so-called occupation. It was the plight of the Palestinian people. It wasn't looking after their own constituents and their own voters, who were the 2 million Israeli Arab citizens of the state of Israel. Mansour Abbas kind of flipped over that paradigm. And like you mentioned about Ayman Ouda, there was hope or thought in the beginning when he was being branded the Martin Luther King Jr. of Israel, that that's what he would do. But that did not happen. It happened with Mansour Abbas. And he's been very, you know, strong in his condemnations, obviously, of terrorism. He's been working closely with the government to acquire and obtain the budgets that are necessary to improve the infrastructure, because there is infrastructure that needs to be improved. But he's also been very supportive of police operations that need to round up those 300,000-400,000 illegal arms that are in the Arab sector. And the Arab sector, we saw videos coming out of Rahat, the Bedouin town, just a couple days ago, of just the pure anarchy and violence there, of Arab on Arab crime that needs to stop, for the sake of the Arabs and for the sake of everyone who lives in the state of Israel. Ayman Ouda, though, is still stuck, I think, and that's how I kind of read into it, in the old paradigm of Israeli-Arab relationship with the state. It's not about the Israeli Arabs, it's about the Palestinians again. He's falling back on that old mantra, whether it's for political gain or because it's out of ideology.
Right, because, you know, you said that he talked about Arabs working with the Zionists, but, you know, he was talking about working with the criminal occupation.
Right.
And that, I suppose, includes Bnei Brak, where an Israeli Arab police officer was killed by a Palestinian just a couple weeks ago. The Israeli occupation of Bnei Brak, which, by the way, is mentioned in the Seder there just to know, you know, how ancient an Israeli city that is.
Yeah, that's where they had the story of the Haggadah all the way to the morning, right? That was in Bnei Brak?
Correct.
Yes.
The actual location of it, which this is also just a fun fact, the actual location of ancient Bnei Brak is now Tzomet Misubim, the Misubim intersection. And in the Haggadah, it says that they were Misubim, that they were, you know, enjoying their festive meal until the morning.
Isn't Tzomet Misubim, though, where we used to have a big trash
It's right there.
Mound. Yes, it's right there. But, you know, I mean, if we're already on the topic of Bnei Brak, right, and this kind of fits into Ayman Uda, the mayor of Bnei Brak went to the family of Amir Khoury, the Christian Arab police officer who gave his life to stop the terror rampage in Bnei Brak that left 4 civilians dead 2 weeks ago, met with him. You see, there's a beautiful image of the mayor of Bnei Brak, an ultra-Orthodox Haredi man, long black coat, long, you know, black hat, beard, hugging the father of this Christian Arab policeman. And I think the city has also announced, they voted on this already, that they're going to be naming a street in memory of Amir Khoury. I mean, yes. that is exactly the type of relationship that Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs should be having, not what people like Ayman Uda are trying to promote and push, which is just more division, hate, incitement. Very unfortunate, very sad. We have to hope that people don't listen to him.
You know, you look at last May when we had our Operation Guardian of the Walls, and then at the same time, there was all of this violent rioting against Jews in mixed Arab-Jewish cities. And in some cases, you know, the Jews fought back. But those kinds of things, unfortunately, I think will keep happening until there's a critical mass of people who understand that the way to have a peaceful future here is for us to live together and to not keep trying to push each other out. And that's apparently Ayman Uda, he claims to understand that. He claims to say, you know, but I think that he wants it only on the terms of the Palestinians and not on, you know, more democratic terms.
Which goes to the core question of, you know, why is there terrorism? Why does it continue? Why do these people still pick up arms and try to murder Israelis, right? And everyone tries to give a lot of different explanations. It's the economy. It's the infrastructure. It's the incitement in the schools. It's a million different reasons. But it also just comes down to a question of really at the base and the foundation, I think, Lahav, is, you know, what do these people want? And sadly, they want to just try to kill as many people as they can, right? And that's still there.
They want us out of here.
Exactly. And you know, we can come up and look, I think that the government has so far been smart in the way that it's been approaching this is, yes, it's cracking down on places like Jenin. It's, you know, filling the holes in the security barrier where needed. It's taking action against, like you mentioned, the cabinet decisions, things like that. But it's also not punishing every Palestinian, right? It's still allowing the Palestinian workers and laborers into Israel. It's talking about Gaza, thankfully, still quiet. The number there is like, I think, 12,000, 13,000 Arabs from Gaza who are allowed into Israel to work every day. They're talking about increasing it to 20,000, right? There's an understanding that you do have to, you can't just look at it through you can't pigeonhole the fight on terror. You have to look at it through a wide array of different steps and means that you have to take. But still, the foundation is, like you said, they don't want us here.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, I think the government is trying to strike a good balance now, but the more terrorist attacks there are, the harder it will be to maintain the balance, and the more likely Israel will have to go into a much broader operation to, you know, uproot the terrorist cells. So it's very tricky, and it's sort of like, it's almost like we have to like say to the Palestinians, like, you know, the more of us you kill, the more all of you are going to suffer, even the ones who aren't killing us, because there's no other way to do it. And I just hope it doesn't come to that.
Sadly, I don't think they're thinking, and the people who are picking up weapons, whether it's a gun, an assault rifle, or a knife, are not necessarily thinking in the long-term strategic impact of what they're doing. Because also the mere thought that you're going to kill two people on Dizengoff or four people in Bnei Brak, like that's going to lead to the end of the state of Israel is this whole thing.
Right. They just freed Palestine.
Exactly. Not yet. Not yet. On the other hand, another, you know, maybe a sharp turn, but to another adversary that wants to free Palestine and destroy the state of Israel is our good friend, the Iran, right? And we saw what seems to be something of a success maybe to Israeli diplomacy over the weekend when the U.S. State Department said that President Joe Biden is opposed to delisting the IRGC Quds Force from the FTO, from the foreign terrorist organization list. Interesting that they specifically mentioned the Quds Force and not the entire IRGC, but is this, you know, Israel had been pushing back when there were reports that the Biden administration might be doing this in the framework of the renewed nuclear negotiations in Vienna. Is this success? Is this an Israeli success, Alahav?
I would say it's a potential success. It looks like the past 6 weeks of Israel pushing specifically on this issue of the IRGC has been effective. I mean, within a few days of, I think it was like 2 days after Prime Minister Bennett revealed to the world that Iran is trying to get the IRGC delisted from the Foreign Terrorist Organization list, we already had in the Jerusalem Post House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer saying that he doesn't think that that's going to pass Congress. There's not going to be votes for that. So that already showed like a lack of political will in Washington. And then, you know, weeks and weeks of Israel talking about this. I mean, I think we had discussed there were a couple of weeks where they weren't talking about Iran at all because of Ukraine. But other than that, you know, this has been the big issue. Last week, Bennett's diplomatic advisor, Shimrit Meir, was in Washington, and she was meeting with Jake Sullivan and other top officials and again, talking about the same issue. And while she was still there, Secretary of State Blinken was asked, is the IRGC a terrorist organization? And he said yes, but then he was like, I don't want to expand on what's going on in the talks. And then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Milley, said in Congress when asked that the IRGC Quds Force is a terrorist organization, doesn't think it should be delisted.
Correct.
But he said Quds Force, not the IRGC as a whole. And then the next day, a State Department spokesperson said that President Biden feels the same way. And then a day after that, there was an article in the Washington Post that Biden will not budge. He does not think that the IRGC issue is the same as the nuclear file, and he doesn't think that that needs to happen. So it looks like, right, that Jerusalem's strategy was very effective and that Shimrit Meir being in Washington was very effective. And part of me hopes that, I mean, I very much hope that's true. But first of all, like, nothing is final. Second of all, as David Ignatius wrote in the Washington Post, like, this is not the same as the nuclear file. And Iran could just switch tactics and say, okay, we want something else to go with the nuclear deal, and then we could still have a nuclear deal. And then what did we gain by this? It's like a very, it's an important thing, but it's very small compared to the entire nuclear deal. And the third thing is that I don't even know if Israel is getting what it wants because of this detail of the Quds Force, which is like only one-fifth of the IRGC, as opposed to just saying the IRGC. So it's a potential victory, but I think we still don't know.
So we still don't know. And the negotiations, though, for the time being, are not necessarily moving forward, though, right? In other words, whether this will derail those talks or won't derail those talks, it's still too early to tell. But the symbolism is important, at least, right?
Yeah, it looks good for Israel. It looks good in the sense that the U.S. is listening to its allies in the region. It's not just Israel. It's also the UAE and Bahrain who opposed it. And look, the longer I think the talks are stalled, the less likely the U.S. is to return to a deal that Israel views as dangerous. The question is just what will come instead of that deal.
And the other question is what will be of the Bennett government, right? You
whoever is prime minister, whether it's Bennett, Lapid, or Netanyahu after an election or something, they all oppose the Iran deal.
They all oppose the Iran deal. But it'll become a question, obviously, of who gets to take the success or the credit for potentially stopping this, but the Bennett government is not yet in safe waters, right? Resignation or the departure of Idit Silman, the coalition whip from the coalition, and her move over to the opposition within the Knesset, it's still 60-60. Netanyahu hasn't succeeded yet in getting another member of Knesset to come over and to get a majority for the opposition. But things still aren't looking that great for the Bennett government, and its days might be numbered.
Yeah, we're still sort of in the same situation as we were last week. Nobody has followed Edith Thielmann to, you know, leave the coalition. And I think that we're going to be in this shaky situation for the next month or so, because the Knesset only returns from its recess in about a month. So there's no reason, and there's nothing really that could be done. Because there's no reason to call an emergency meeting of the Knesset in order to call an election. So,
right. A shaky political situation.
Yeah.
How innovative for the state of Israel, right? I feel like we've been through that before. But, getting to our interview this week, we spoke, like I mentioned in the beginning, with Gal Hirsch, former IDF general, one of the brains or the behind Operation Defensive Shield that was launched 20 years ago and kind of saw the IDF go back into the West Bank and pretty much stay there since then. And we spoke to him. It was interesting to hear him talk about the beginning of that operation, how it came to be, what the lessons were from it, and how, or if there is anything that can be applied to the current terror wave that Israel is facing right now. Here we go. Our guest this week is Gal Hirsch, a former IDF Brigadier General, widely regarded, I would even say, as one of the military's more creative and innovative officers in recent years. Stepped down from the IDF a number of years ago, but the reason we're talking to Gal this week is because, as probably many of you listeners know, Friday night is the beginning of the Pesach holiday, the Passover holiday, and it was 20 years ago that the Park Hotel bombing took place in Netanya, a suicide attack that left, in the end, 30 people dead. And it's what spurred and set off an operation called Defensive Shield. Gal Hirsch was then the, I would say, chief operations officer for the Central Command, and was not only one of the main officers who oversaw the operation, but also, and Gal, you'll tell us about this, was also the officer who came up with the name for the operation, which today everyone remembers this operation, Chomat Magen in Hebrew, Defensive Shield in English. But it was you, Gal, who came up with the name. So before we dive into the name, let's say, I am curious, take us back 20 years in time. Where are you, Seder night 2002?
Well, I just left the Central Command on my way to my family's house, hoping to be a part of the Seder evening. And I knew that these days, I did not expect to be all along the Seder night. I knew that the situation is very fragile and we were under massive, intensive terror attacks these days. But just when I entered, saying Chag Sameach and Shalom, my beeper just told me that a terrible sabotage action took place in Park Hotel in Netanya. And the following beep was from the Central Command asking me to go immediately to the Chief of General Staff and to the Minister of Defense. They are waiting for me. And I was just running through the stairs to the street to my jeep, and the family, you know, I left home many times to special operations, missions, wars, but this time for today's, it's unbelievable days of attacks, more than 130 casualties, and only in this Black March 2002. Everybody knew that we are only waiting for casus belli, for the spark that will turn on our operation. And when I was running to my jeep, the family used an old Jewish tradition and throwing water after myself, because that's a belief that, you know, if the water comes back always to the same place, so the warrior will be back. So I was I just left home, couldn't be really in a Seder night, but running to the Chief of General Staff, knowing that from now on things won't be the same.
You know, you talked about that month being such a horrible, just violent month, but the Intifada had been going on for a year and a half at that point. I mean, it was September 2000, right, when the attacks really started. So what was the shift that sort of made the top brass at the IDF realize that they need a major operation?
Well, actually, as our audience know, the friction between us and the Palestinian terrorists and Palestinian terrorist forces started during the Oslo Accord process. We were in the middle of peace process, and let me just remind our audience, since the beginning of the 90s, we, the Israel Defense Forces, were a part of implementing peace process. We wanted very much to believe in peace, but they've decided to follow Nasrallah's terminology and Nasrallah's inspiration after May 2000, when Israel has made its withdrawal from Lebanon. When Nasrallah told them during his famous speech in Bin Jbel, May 2000, that Israel is very weak and they should also open fire and fight against us, they were completely inspired by that. And it exactly matched Yasser Arafat's wishes that he will build his nation and his state with blood and fire. So we knew that things like this may happen. And for us, the wake-up call was Nakba Day of May 2000 in Judea and Samaria and Gaza, when Palestinian Authority forces opened fires. And it was not the first time. Let me remind you, September 1996 with Hashmonaim tunnel events, when they opened fire and killed 17 IDF soldiers and 80 were badly injured. So we knew that things like this may happen, and we were well prepared for September 2000. Second Intifada started last days of September 2000. Now, we saw the escalation, but alongside our warfare against Palestinian forces, September, October, November, December 2000, and then going into 2001, we thought that it may be really bumper on the road. Maybe we will be back to the negotiations for peace agreement according to Oslo Accord. But parallel to fighting, the politicians kept preserve the peace process. Now, we were in a unique situation where our legitimacy battery was completely empty. Completely empty, because somehow the Palestinians succeeded to turn the story of David and Goliath into a different type of narrative. They were David, we were Goliath. And they always told the world that they are the weak side and we are using excessive forces. And since our legitimacy battery was empty, we were allowed to do less operations and, of course, not to go into a strike against them, because the situation really changed, according to your question, Lahav, only in September 11th and the tragedy in Manhattan, in the Pentagon, the Twins, of course, and in Pennsylvania. September 11th actually brought to the world GWAT, Global War on Terror, declared by President Bush. And from now on, our context of our fighting against terrorism was global context. And our legitimacy battery, these days I knew during the summer of 2001, just before September 11th, that I must prepare an operation that later on was called Defensive Shield Operation. It meant to be a strike that will actually put a big blanket on a bonfire of terrorism all around Judea, Samaria, Jordan Valley, Gaza Strip, and of course the mass populated areas of Israel.
I'm curious, first of all, the name, which has now become such a trademark, how did you come up with the name? That's number one. And number two is, when you look back on the operation, it's very much perceived as being a huge success for the state of Israel, right? As like this battle that defeated terrorism in the West Bank. Now, what a lot of people forget is that what it was maybe like an opening salvo, right? It was the return of the IDF to West Bank cities, and then Israel retained its presence for all those years since then. So if you could also kind of elaborate on the idea behind the operation and its true significance in the 20 years that have passed.
Well, you are completely right that the name defensive shield today, it's a synonym to a big strike, something that can solve problems or deep problems. Many people are speaking today about defensive shield operation should be done again in Gaza Strip, or we must use defensive shield operation against criminality in the Arab sector and things like this. The defensive shield operation actually showed that we can systematically dismantle a threat. That's the main idea of defensive shield operation. When I thought about planning it, I tried to look for a metaphor, and from that metaphor actually to go from designing into planning. And that's the way you should plan when you speak about operational and strategic levels. You go from metaphor into detailed planning. So the metaphor for me was actually just to try and solve this problem with fire everywhere, all around Israel. And actually to put it down immediately together and parallel all around Judea, Samaria, and the West Bank. I was sorry that I was not in charge of Gaza Strip. Actually, this blanket went ahead to go into details by planning. What does it mean, a blanket on a fire? What does it mean? It means five divisions. It means all the capabilities of special forces and commandos. It means all our intelligence capabilities. It means recruiting our reserves. And it means actually one of the biggest operations the IDF made ever. Now, when you think about that, such operations of five divisions, this is something that has happened, as you know, during Yom Kippur War 1973 and also in 1982 in Lebanon, First Lebanon War, but never in such a density, in urban terrain. We wanted not to harm the civilians there that are human shields, and we did not want to cause collateral damage. So it means to develop unique tactics, operational maneuvers, and unique strategic concept. Now, speaking about the name, I know that defensive name for offensive maneuver is much better, of course. But I really believed that we must be, as our name calls us, Israel Defense Forces. And I must be honest with you, that days of what you call Second Intifada, I personally and many of my colleagues and comrades, we felt that we are failing to protect the state of Israel, because people today remember the last 2 weeks with 14 Israelis that were murdered by terrorists in Be'er Sheva, Hadera, Bnei Brak, and Tel Aviv. But let me remind our audience that that days before defensive shield operation, each bus that was exploded by suicide bomber actually murdered 18, 20, 30 people in each sabotage action. And it happened almost every day. I felt that we must find a way to be Israel Defense Forces and not to feel that failure. And I knew that we must be the defensive shield for the old people of Israel and to the weak people and to the young people. Song written by Chaim Hefer, which is a very famous poet, and he wrote many, many words and songs, very popular songs, during our independence war. And on my way back from Tel Aviv, from the chief of general staff, after meeting the minister of defense, Ben Eliezer, and when I got the green light to turn on defensive shield strike, almost as planned, I was on my way to Jerusalem, ordering many of my forces, many of my troops to be prepared, calling the reserves and giving orders and setting the schedule for the next few hours. And then one of my young officers called from the war room and told me, sir, the name of the contingency plan is Sadeh Acher. Sadeh Acher in English means a different field. do you want us to leave?
Not as catchy a name.
No, not the same type of names. It was just a code name. And she asked me, do you want us to leave it this way when we are now actually moving into action? And I asked her to wait a second. It was just near Latrun, you know, on our way to Jerusalem, road number one. I was driving very fast. All my radio systems were shouting and yelling inside the car. And I told her, listen, there is a famous song written by Chaim Hefer. He is saying there that we must be defensive shield for the people of Israel. And this why the name should be defensive. You know, I felt that this is history. And she told me, so, Colonel, what's the name? I told her, defensive shield. She said, whatever you say, and hang off the phone. So she was she was much more practical. She thought about giving the order. So that was the way that the name defensive shield is being created. But let me tell you, it is not only the name. It is actually the way we loaded the name with content. The content of defensive shield operation that showed how we move from house to house, from cave to cave, from shelter to shelter, systematically with five divisions and parallel avoiding collateral damage. This is something that is unique in the history of armies worldwide.
So I want to bring us to today, not necessarily the events of the last few weeks, but now 20 years later, what do you think is the legacy of Operation Defensive Shield? What does the IDF still do or still know today because of that operation?
Well, I think that the most important thing of Defensive Shield's legacy is the existence of this option and the self-confidence we have that we can do that. We can do that. Of course, we can do that in Gaza. We can do that in Jenin. If terror will be back again to the levels of Second Intifada, we can do it in Judea, Samaria, and everywhere. Actually, it shows that we can be creative, that we can be lethal to the terrorists, and we can avoid collateral damage and maneuver selectively. We can do that. And it shows also the most important thing, love. It shows that the people of Israel that were praying for peace and believed and wanted to give a chance for peace during the Oslo Accord. These days of the 90s, we were in negotiations with Syria in Washington. And of course, the peace process with the Palestinians became a reality. The people of Israel started to believe that peace on earth arrives. And this is why the disappointment was so big. And this is why, after these massive, intensive terror attacks in the mass populated areas of Israel, the people of Israel has decided that they are ready to pay prices for their freedom, for their security, and for their sense of security. And when I gave the orders of calling the reserves, you know, we did not know what to do because I called five divisions, but all the divisions wanted to participate. You know, if you have 100% capability of gearing up soldiers and giving the right equipment for the people for urban warfare and calling only 100% of your soldiers, 130% came. All the people that actually were asked to leave the service because, for example, they were too old, or maybe they were ill, or for other reasons. They all came to the warehouse as they wanted to participate in the war. The people of Israel, the public opinion, the Israeli spirit was in its best that days. And this is actually the most important thing of defensive shield operation. It showed, first of all, to ourselves and to the rest of the world, that when the Israeli people are standing up and going into warfare, actually they can dismantle any threat. And this spirit is the most important legacy of defensive shield, and it goes alongside with the military capability of the Israel Defense Forces actually to confront any challenge like this in the close region and the far region.
Gal, but isn't also part of the legacy the fact that in the years since, the IDF has basically had operational freedom in the West Bank, right? The process that you spoke about earlier on in the interview of the withdrawal and the peace process and how we thought we were in negotiations and that peace was upon us. But Defensive Shield brought the IDF back into the Palestinian cities and basically also changed the mindset, I would say, to a large extent among many Israeli, definitely Israelis, but also Israeli politicians, that under any possible future peace deal with the Palestinians, we would not so easily be able to give up operational freedom in Judea and Samaria in the West Bank.
You're completely right, Yaakov. I think that the Defensive Shield operation, actually, the meaning and the purpose of Defensive Shield operation was, first of all, to bring a strike. It means to block the Palestinian terror waves that were running day by day into the mass populated areas of Israel and to many Israeli streets all around Israel. And that days, we were under peace process with the Palestinians, and we had to respect the peace agreements that were achieved until that days. And it meant that we cannot enter freely into A zones. A zones were signed on the maps with brown color. And A zone means that this is completely sovereign area of the Palestinian Authority, and we are not allowed to enter inside. And, you know, it sounds very naive maybe, but we really respected the peace process. I believe that this is our way. And we were not allowed to be there everywhere whenever we want. After Defensive Shield operation, after we've dismantled all the terror infrastructure systematically, actually, the policy has changed. And you are right. Today, we can arrive 24/7 into each bed of a terrorist or someone that helps him, and to each explosive laboratory in Judea, Samaria, and around. And this is why, actually, after Defensive Shield operation, after I launched another operation called Determined Path that followed Defensive Shield operation, which for about a year, we kept dismantling every infrastructure the Palestinians built in Judea and Samaria. Actually, the situation in Israel completely changed. The young generation today know Israel as startup nation. We think much more about the great Israeli kitchen. We think and we hope that after COVID-19, we will be back to the massive numbers of tourists that come to visit Israel. But let me remind us all, during the second Intifada, just before Defensive Shield operation, Israel was in a halt. We were under siege. No one really wanted to visit this place. It was real danger. And Defensive Shield operation changed it completely. Israel is today a safe place. And our policy is to arrive to the terrorists before they even start to move. And this is why the Israelis feel in the last 2 weeks this terrible feeling that they feel vulnerable. They feel that terrorists enter into the mass populated areas freely. But as you know, fighting terrorism is something that you want to believe that you will dismantle 100% of the efforts of terrorists. But this is a tough game. It is a big challenge. And we are working 24/7. My colleagues, my subordinates, my comrades in the reserves, working 24/7. IDF, Israel Secret Services, the Israeli Special Forces, in order to try our best that terrorists won't move freely from their territories.
So what do you think, first of all, that maybe Israel or security forces had done wrong that allowed for this wave of terrorism to rear its head? And what do you think we need to do moving forward to ensure that it doesn't get worse?
Well, since I know the people that are in command of our brigades, our special forces, our secret services, and I know them personally, I'm counting on them. And they're working 24/7 to make sure that things like we are facing in the last 2 weeks won't happen. And let's not forget, in the last 20 years, we're enjoying security. Yes, from time to time, we see stabbing events and low-tech terrorism and lone wolves, as you remember from 2015 in Israel, and such phenomena as became the reality in Europe as well, and in Australia, in United States of America, and other places. Terror exists. Radical fundamentalists are there. And this living spring of terrorism, unfortunately, is still there. And let's not forget that we are facing, and our reality is that there is a living spring of terrorism, actually, that produced terrorism 24/7, which is Iran, that actually is using the Revolutionary Guard, and they're using Quds Force, and they're using their proxies as Hezbollah, Hamas, Iranian militias, Houthis, and others, in order to produce terror. And I do not think that actually there is something that the IDF's commanders or the Secret Services commanders did wrong. There are lessons learned that must be made from what we call as failure. If someone enters into Tel Aviv, Hadera, Bnei Brak, or Be'er Sheva, and successfully, unfortunately, murder Israelis, we must learn and to try to be much better and much better, because learning and studying and making sure that we will be with one step ahead always and precede the precedent, this is something that we must do 24/7. And that's what we're doing. But you cannot expect 100% success. Unfortunately, the enemy learns, is fast, is agile. Terrorists are learning us around the clock. And they are looking for our vulnerabilities, looking for places that they can infiltrate inside our mass populated areas, inside our vulnerabilities, and kill Israelis. It happens worldwide, but it happens here, and that's what's the most important thing for us. And we must make sure that we will have the strength and the talent to be effective and learn faster than our enemies. It's a big, big challenge.
Well, Gal, it was great to have you and to hear the experience and the stories from 20 years ago and the lessons that can be applied today. We wish you a Chag Sameach, and that this Pesach, this Seder, will stay quiet for you and for everyone. So thank you very much.
I really hope so, I hope that the people of Israel will enjoy a happy and quiet Pesach. Before closing, let me just ask our audience to remember one important thing. We depend on the education of the young generation of Israel. They will have to work in the next generation to protect and guard the state of Israel because it is not finished. Defensive shield operation is defensive shield operation one. There will be a second one and there will be a third one. And unfortunately, we will always pray for peace, but the state of Israel is in the Middle East, and in the Middle East, the strike and striking again is unfortunately the methodology that can preserve quiet security and sense of security for the people of Israel. And we depend on the next generation, the young children, girls and boys that unfortunately will have to wear uniform, recruit to the Israel Defense Forces and later on to the other secret services and other security alignments of Israel and protect the state of Israel.
All right. With that in mind, we wish you a happy Pesach and thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Lahav. Thank you very much, Yaakov. Shalom.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. Yaakov and I want to wish you a Chag Sameach V'Kasher, a happy and kosher Passover. Enjoy your Seder with your family. We are going to be off for Pesach, so we'll be back in 2 weeks. In the meantime, if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends and family. We're available on all the major podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple, etc. And we'll see you in 2 weeks.